setting up shop.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Setting Up Shop, possibly your favorite podcast, possibly just a bit of filler when you're waiting for another episode from someone else to come out. Either way, we're happy for you to be listening to us. We really appreciate it. Tell your friends, invite them in, and tell them to come and listen to our dulcet tones. Today, as always, it is myself, Dan, a woodturner from the UK, and joined by Rasmus Lowen, a blacksmith from Norway.
Hello.
And Heidi Jacobs, a potter from America.
Hey there.
So this week, well, a little bit of backstory. We actually started recording last week, and then I had an epic power cut halfway through, which I think we've decided was an act of God telling us that what we were talking about was kind of dull. So we've decided not to revisit that topic because I think all of us were struggling a little bit with actually trying to make it engaging and relevant. And so we thought we'd take a step back this time and relax a little bit. And we're going to do it. We're going to talk about this. We're going to do a snobbery episode. Okay. And this might become a recurring thing. All right. This is an opportunity for us to purely voice our opinion. We are all three of us aware that this is our opinion. People will think we are wrong. That's fine. It's just those little things that kind of, when you've been going a little bit further along in your craft than being a beginner, you look at some things and you think, why do people think that's good? Or various other things. We are freely admitting that some of this stuff may come across as arrogant. We are not intending to offend anyone by this. This is almost, in a way, a bit of a vent episode. Okay? If you think you're going to be triggered by anything we're going to say, turn us off, switch the button off, maybe skip the episode, ask a friend to listen to it, and get them to let you know you think there's going to be anything in here that causes offense. It is not our intention. All right. So that being said, we're going to have a bit of fun at the same time. We're each going to pick one thing from either past or present within our own sphere of making, creating, crafting. And we're going to explain what it is, because there will be some listeners who may not be aware, and explain why we feel frustrated or otherwise about it. Okay? I think this should be fun. It'll be okay. Mm. It shouldn't descend into anarchy too quickly anyway.
Well.
We'll wait and see. Heidi, I'm going to descend upon Heidi first.
Oh, wow.
Because she's laughing the hardest. What's your first point of snobbishness in your craft?
It's the consistent response to a broken mug or broken plate or something where it's, well, can't you just kintsugi it? So if you're not aware what kintsugi is, it's basically a Japanese technique of repairing ancient pottery. And this is a technique that's like, really can be very difficult and can be very beautiful. It's a heritage technique. So in certain countries, porcelainware is handed down from generation to generation. And when pieces break, it's custom to repair them the best you can. And people with the advanced skills are able to use gold luster to repair their pieces. And so then it turns out like any time, like generation after generation, things are going to, you know, get broken and they present with very beautiful character after they've been broken. And not saying like my work is throwaway work, but it's certainly not heritage worthy work where it would make sense to take the time and energy and effort to do this technique to repair my pieces. It's actually easier for me to just throw a new one. And the quality of my work doesn't really really need to be preserved in that kind of way. But one of the things that really, like, I don't know, it's kind of, it's not like a huge irritation, but people that take that art form and say like, oh, just kintsugi it, it's kind of like...
Yeah, almost belittling a very strong cultural thing that is meant to honor. Because we've experienced a similar thing in woodturning where people are starting to have done like fake kintsugi where they will turn a piece, like
gold powder,
and then they'll carve cracks into it and fill it with like gold wire or gold leaf or whatever, and try and make it look like a ceramic. Which, if you are deliberately, if you're just experimenting with technique for the sake of experimenting with technique, great. If you're turning a one-off art piece, or if you've been asked to make a series that emulates that, sure, great, cool. But yeah, I think a lot of that, you've also got the risk of cultural appropriation, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Japanese are really known for their wabi-sabi, which is, I think we've talked about this before with like the philosophy of embracing flawed or imperfect things. And, you know, some people abuse that too, where it's like, oh, it's just wabi-sabi, you know, where it's like, oh, I'm just not really good at my craft. And so therefore I'm going to lean into this like natural feel or natural looking thing versus like truly perform, like it's more performative. It's not really truly the aesthetic that falls under Japanese wabi-sabi. But one of the things that Dan, you were talking about with like showcasing the imperfections is part of that mentality of, you know, the life of something, the wear and tear of something is also part of the story of an object. And just emulating it for like the visual kind of like,
Well,
eliminates the whole story of the piece.
Yeah. It feels like you're creating a false background.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You're taking a really well-crafted original piece of art and then you're doing a Disney knockoff and kind of forcing it down people's throats and telling them to ignore the actual storyline because it looks pretty.
Yeah. I think it like detaches you a bit from it. Go ahead, Rasmus. Sorry.
No, the whole kintsugi is a, as far as I understand the Japanese culture of all of this, and granted, it's...
I should just point out for the listener, sorry to cut you off, Raz. I should point out for the listener, Raz has actually been to Japan and has partially learned the language. So out of the three of us here, he is probably the closest thing we have to someone who's actually got some level of authority on this subject. So carry on, Raz.
Yeah, I can pretend to have some authority, but like I know that there's a lot of depth to the Japanese culture that I don't grasp yet. And it's been at least 15 years since I lived there. So it's like pinch of salt and all of that. But like the Japanese, pretty much like the Norwegians in that sense, don't have a sense of cultural appropriation. So like they are more than happy to just share everything and like give everything out. But there's a lot of honor and tradition that goes with some things that they don't expect anyone else to understand. So they give you sort of the Disney version of their culture because that's what they think you can understand. And then they keep sort of the true essence of it for themselves. And the use of kintsugi inside the mental framework of wabi-sabi has kind of turned into that the way I see it. And I agree with Heidi here that it used to be a technique to put together something that was broken because you value the piece itself and the history it symbolized and the people you got it from. Then in the whole wabi-sabi thing, it is the fact of accepting that nothing is perfect. And there is a fair amount around the world of crafting traditions where you add a flaw on purpose because only whatever deity you believe in is perfect. So you're never trying to imitate perfection. You are adding your own flaws to it so that you're not trying to compete with perfection.
That's interesting. I haven't heard of that concept before.
Yeah, so that's maybe not a big part of wabi-sabi in that sense, because the culture in Japan is built upon an entire different religion than what we have in the West. Like they have nothing monotheistic at all. But then kintsugi is more of just respect for the piece itself and also accepting that something can break and still be useful. And that as an analog for human beings as well.
Yeah. I love the non-attachment attitude that the Japanese culture has with material things. But it's also interesting to me that the non-attachment also creates this attachment in this other way, where it's like, I honor the piece, but I let go of the need for it to look the way that it was when I bought it or when it was handed to me. Like, the non-attachment attachment is like mind-blowing to me, especially being an American where like we're all about materialism, or all about ownership, or all about like, this is mine, yeah. My precious. But
well, but I think the big difference is, and I might be overstepping a fair bit, but I think a big difference is the Japanese value the purpose of the thing.
Mm.
But I have a feeling we in the West, and maybe Americans more than many others, value the look and symbol of the thing. And as soon as that facade, yeah, and as soon as that facade is cracked, it is no longer useful because it portrays something less than perfect. Yeah. Suddenly,
I do want to clarify, like, I'm not salty about anyone that, and I've had some people do this before. I'm not salty about anyone that has taken my pottery and done kintsugi. Like, totally not upset about that at all. It's more the attempt to showcase a Band-Aid without understanding the history and the culture behind it is more what's, I think, frustrating to me. Like, I've known other people that have like really valued something that I've given them and done kintsugi or their version of kintsugi. And it turned out really cool. And, you know, that's really great. But the, I don't know, taking it and making it a style. is really, I think, where, and this is a good conversation because it's helping me understand like why it's ick to me, like that I'm more frustrated by people just not really understanding what it is and just being like, oh yeah, can't you just
I think an awful lot of the stuff that the three of us will come up with that we feel snobbish about will be frustration at ignorance, whether that's either people on social media who think they're being helpful but are ignorant of why you might not see that as helpful, or people who don't understand why people might not necessarily get offended, but will be put off or reject something they make because they don't understand the reasoning and the cultural and the historical backgrounds to why something used to happen in the way that they've made something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aligned.
Yeah. Yeah. Rasmus, what's your first one?
The use of railroad spikes in blacksmithing.
Okay. In what context? As in using them all as a raw material?
All of them. Okay. Now, it's not fully that bad, but it's just turned into, it feels like it's a very cheap way of pretending to be creative by going on Pinterest and taking scrap metal from a different sort of thing and making it into some kind of tools or utensils or just hooks or anything. And it's just the fact of the magic of blacksmithing is taking something that is more or less immalleable, heating it up, making it plastic and shaping it into something else. And in my view, a good piece of blacksmithing, you shouldn't really be able to tell what you started out with.
Okay.
That's a design philosophy. And every single piece of what you're making should be forged in some way. Granted, I don't always do this myself, but when you take sort of a railroad spike because you saw it on Pinterest and you are doing what everyone else is doing with a railroad spike, whether that's making a like a barbecue flipper or knife. A knife, which is a very bad material for a knife by itself, or making a tomahawk or something like that, is sort of like, yeah, you are not being creative. And it's not like that. I find that personally really insulting. It's just like, it seems creatively cheap.
Okay. So are you frustrated when you see anyone do it? Or are you frustrated when you see someone who you know is further along a journey than starting out do it? Or are you frustrated when you see people do it when they're clearly doing it for social media interaction?
I think it's a combination of just doing it for interaction or it's kind of a cheap fallback when they could do better, in my opinion.
Okay.
Both creatively and sort of as a skill.
Yeah. What I'm getting at is if someone was just getting into blacksmithing / metalworking and all they'd seen was a load of that stuff and they had easy access to railroad spikes and they made a thing, you're not frustrated by that necessarily as much as you are by someone who has got some knowledge and understanding and experience and access to better materials and tools, and they've chosen to
I would consider it bad for a beginner to only focus on making things out of railroad spike because you are limiting your ability of practice buy this material.
Okay.
Like, if you actually have an interest in becoming better of the craft, I think you should start with doing all the other things, then focus on sort of scratching that itch of doing the railroad spike stuff, and then move on to doing better things. That's what I feel like.
What material is the railroad spike? Like, when you're talking about the steel or the, is it iron? Is a railroad spike iron?
All of it is basically steel at this point, okay. But it's very, like, it's very low carbon steel.
Okay.
Some of them have enough carbon that you can, in theory, harden it, and it might hold an edge for a little while, but none of it is actually, quote unquote, good material for anything other than tying down the railroad.
It's like a staple.
Kind of, yeah. quite literally. It is tying the track down to the crossbeams of a railroad.
So if, would you have the same reaction if someone was making something, had been requested to make something for a historical railroad?
No, but that's a purpose.
Place.
Then it is with a good purpose.
But there's like a purpose before where they're using that material to make a thing.
Yeah, but I think...
I'm not trying to be awkward. I'm genuinely trying to understand the kind
of... I'm also trying to, like, Heidi sort of talk through, like, what is the essence of why this is annoying to me.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's, like, if it is, in this case, portraying a connection to something else.
Mm-hmm.
Like yeah, if I had someone come up to me and say, like, hey, my dad used to run a steam locomotive. I want something to remember him by.
Yeah.
And he had this bucket of railroad spikes in his garage. Can you do something with this? Mm-hmm. Then I'm like, yes, of course. Like, I am using this railroad spike as the symbolism of the guy.
Yeah, so you'd make a whole bunch of throwing knives and a big circular wheel and like a draw out of a person on them. And it's naturally all linked to the locomotive. Yeah. Okay.
But I just feel like it is the whole, you fall into sort of a creative pitfall where you limit yourself too much. And like you said, I think it's quote unquote bad for the community to do so much and highlight so much of it. But it is fair. It's kind of like with the epoxy river tables. New people come in who's not previously all that creative, and they see this thing and they go like, oh, that's cool. I see where you started with.
Mm.
Or that's shiny and that sort of so that immediate reaction.
Your issue isn't so much with the material exactly.
No.
It's more with having it still look like a railroad spike at the end of the day. Like, oh, well, this is... It's just the handle at that point. It's not really.
Yeah.
Okay. I hear you. And I think I'm trying to relate it to more like a bastardization of the craft.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, well, this is like really a lukewarm entry point. And if people continue with this lukewarm entry point and it's like gets too much traction or too much attention, then people don't move beyond it. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Not to mention, like, the quality of the steel in them can just be difficult to deal with. They are difficult to call and forge. So it's like, if yes, there are points of saying, oh, this is my niche. I think this is cool for whatever reason, and this is the only thing I do. Then, okay, fine. But I still think that's you're creatively limiting yourself a fair bit. Like, there's so many other ways of keeping an aesthetic of like the steam trains, if that's sort of your thing, outside of just using railroad spikes.
Are you also frustrated when people use railroad ties as anvils?
You mean the tracks, you mean?
Yeah.
I mean, no, I'm frustrated by people trying to sell old railroad tracks off as anvils. Or like people who are cut into like I-beams or anything like that, and they have shaped them into a vaguely metal fabrication object. And like, no, like it might have been used to hit stuff on, but that doesn't make it an actual anvil.
Mm-hmm.
You have made a bell with a hard top. And that's kind of how I think about it. Because you have a skinny bit that will just vibrate and make a lot of noise in the middle. And it's like, no.
Uh-huh. We have one. I don't think it's ever been used, but we did get an actual anvil. I don't even know how much it weighs. It's small because we have a tiny little space for it. But
no, and my problem, to be clear, is people mistaking it for an anvil and trying to sell it as an anvil.
Oh, right. But yeah.
It can be a really useful tool. And hang on, I have
moved into the second one now. You've moved into
I just wanted some clarification if you just hated railroads.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. It just hates everything to do with the railroad. Anyone who's ever worked on a railroad, it's just a whole railroad thing.
He's fuck you, choo choo.
That's a t-shirt. Okay, I think this is interesting because I think what we're actually hearing from you, Raz, it's not what I'm getting, and correct me if I'm wrong, Heidi, I don't know if you're on the same as this. What I'm getting from this is your frustration isn't with the material being used. Your frustration is the fact that almost like people haven't looked hard enough to see if that's the best thing that they could start with. Like, they've been lazy with their approach to potentially learning a craft. And
actually, it is creative laziness. That's my issue.
Yeah. Because I think we can all agree that there will be things that people will do that would then inspire them to get into their respective crafts, and that within a year or two's time, they'll look back and go, why the hell did I ever do that? That was dumb or dangerous or looks horrific or whatever the case may be. But again, I can also see the other side of it, where if you've made 15 pieces and they've all used railroad spikes, and then you haven't started looking for any other material or realizing that there might be an easier way or a better material or whatever to do it with, but you've also not realized that and not then lent into it and gone, I don't care, this gets me loads of traction on social media and that's what I'm about, I'm going to become the railroad spike guy, then it still feels creatively lazy. It still feels like you're not really... you're not putting the effort in.
I guess for some reason I just take it a bit personal and people are willing so willfully not trying to push themselves or living up to their potential.
Yeah, but you've got to remember that your standard for yourself is pretty high, Raz, and the amount of hours you put into getting there is abnormal compared to most.
I am.
Even with the few hours of sunlight you get a year, you spend far too much time. That's not true. That's the wrong phrase to use. Far too much time is wrong because it has helped you massively. An abnormal amount of time compared to the rest of the mortal population in achieving your crafts. Okay.
And it's not really that I expect anyone to do the things I do or the way I do them, because I realize how many of those things have been stupid or just excessive. But it's just of, but you could put in 5% more effort and you would actually progress. That would be something. And then people just say, no, I like to stay in my box. And I just don't understand it. I find it weird.
Okay. This is really interesting because this has become much more of a therapy session for each of us than
I think any
of us were intending. And actually, I think this is quite cool. Hopefully, dear listeners, that you're finding this interesting as well. So mine is lying about what you're making is the way I'm going to put it, which comes across as very strong. So there was a trend a little while back, and some people still make them, but there was a trend a little while back, a couple of years ago, where people would turn bowls, and they would post about this bowl that they'd made. And there would be this piece of wood where the outside shape would look like a bowl. And then you'd get to the top, and right in the middle, there'd be a little dip that might be 1, maybe 2 inches in diameter and about 15 millimeters. Let's mix imperial and metric, because why not? 15 millimeters, or just over half an inch and 49 74ths in the middle. Like, that's the depth of it. And then around the outside of that would be like 100 mil or 4 inches of flat space that hadn't been hollowed out, but that would be heavily textured and colored. Okay. To me, if you want to show off texture and color, show off texture and color. Make a wall hanging piece, make like a really big disc and play with texture and color. If you want to play with texture and color on a bowl form, then turn a bowl form, play with texture and color, and don't cut that bit out the middle. Don't pretend that this is a functional piece, that and its function is that, because to me, a bowl is something you can put things in. Now, don't get me wrong, there absolutely you can turn a bowl to be looked at because it is art. I totally respect that as a function. And yeah, okay, you might still turn the middle bit out and no one's going to use it to put things in. But it just felt to me, almost going back to what you said actually, Raz, it felt to me almost like a lazy way of going, I don't know what to call this finished piece, so I'm going to call it a bowl because it's got a divot in the middle.
Mm.
And what would most often happen as well is that they would then potentially gold leaf that divot, or they would do a really stark contrast color or something like that. I don't get me wrong, a lot of people made stunning pieces, like they were really well sanded and textured and finished, and the color choices were amazing. But it just, I couldn't, and this is entirely my failing. This is why it frustrates me, and I'm being snobbish about it, is because why are you bothering with the little bit in the middle? Like, it's not elevating the piece. Okay, you could argue it adds contrast or something like that. But if the point is to showcase all of the stuff around it, then in some ways you've removed that showcase by drawing attention to this piddling little dip in the middle of your piece.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so that was my thing. And it wasn't a case of being frustrated with people who did them, because, you know, you get people who turn one and go, oh, okay, I had a go and it's not for me. Fine, moved on, whatever it might be. But there were some people who were like churning them out, and then I don't think anyone made like an artistic series of them, but it's the kind of thing that you could see someone doing, like, I'll do a small, medium and large size one, and this one's got blue on the outside and then red on the top, and then the other one's got red on the outside and blue on the top, and the textures all linked together, and there's this whole story of like it's a family of bowls or whatever. So yeah, but just call them something else. Do you know what I mean? Just like call them an exploration in texture and color. Like, you don't have to describe what the form is.
You can just call it art instead of pretending it has a function.
I don't even think it's that. I think it was just it just felt like someone made this thing and then went, oh, I don't actually know what to call this so that people can identify with it. So I'll call it a bowl and I'll put this bit in the middle. Mm. And I mean, the secondary frustration, actually the other frustration leads into my second bit of snobberish, so we'll steer away from that. But it just kind of, I understand that sometimes I'll look at a piece and I don't get it. You know, like I don't understand why someone would make it, or I don't understand why it's got popular or whatever. And that will partly be due to not being part of that generation or in that group of people. But that particular thing, just, it still really bothers me. I even talk about it when I've got a captive audience of paying people who are coming to one of my bowl turning courses. I will go on a mini 5-minute talk about what makes something a bowl. Is it because it's got a dip in the middle? You know, and it's like, let's talk about form and function. What actually defines something? So yeah, how about me? Is there anything you guys want to assess on that? Or are we?
Yeah, I mean, it does sound like it's a gray area. Like, is this functional wear, or is this something that is more fine art? Is it even fine art if it's just trying to figure out, you know, oh, these colors look great together.
Yeah.
Let me just stain the top of this to look like this, and let me marble it a little bit with some other techniques with like different tools to like get textures and everything. But I don't know. I've seen people do it, and I've seen people do it like on repeat, like in the turning community, where I've sat and I've watched them do it because it's fascinating. The process is fascinating.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the crux of it, is that the process is the fun part. The end result is kind of laissez-faire. It's like, okay, well, what am I even going to do with this thing? Can I hang it on a wall? Like, does it turn it, should it be a clock? Should it be, you know, is it just something that goes on like one of those plate stands on your entryway? Like, I get that it's kind of like an uncomfortable space to be in, where is this a functional piece? Is this artistic expression? Is this an exploration of the use of color and technique? I can see where you seem like the type of person that really likes to have things clearly defined.
Yeah.
And it probably rubs up against that need of yours to have it like clearly defined, and your use of saying like, well, it's not really a bowl because it's not deep enough. It's not functional enough to be an actual bowl. You need to name it something else because it doesn't fit within my tolerance.
It doesn't fit my tolerance for that. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think you're very right. It's, you know, very much a personal thing, but it doesn't fit in the box of what I would define as being that thing.
And did you feel like maybe your hackles were more raised because it was, I feel like probably like 2020 to 2023 was like was the heyday of that technique where every woodturner that I followed on YouTube was that they were doing something like that during their lives.
Yeah.
It did showcase a lot of opportunity for attention it was more interesting to sit through an entire session of people turning when they were doing something like that. But yeah. I don't know that I'm seeing it as much. Are you seeing it die off at all?
Yeah, I haven't seen anyone doing it, demonstrating it or whatever for quite a while. But then I've probably been a lot more selective the last couple of years about the woodturners that I pay attention to.
Oh, okay.
Not because you can't learn things from people further down the ladder, but because I've got such limited time to pay attention that I would rather pay attention to the guys who are showcasing things much more in line with the stuff that I make. So it's more likely going to benefit me in the long run. That's not to say that you shouldn't ever break away and look around and see what else is happening and be inspired by it. But yeah, I think you're right. It's definitely because it didn't fit in my box of what a bowl was. Mm. But again, as I say, it's so stupid because I think even if they had that dip in the middle, but they literally had a different name. it just had a different name. Do you know what I mean?
It's a name.
Like,
yeah.
Just like, you know, a decorative form.
But okay. I have two thoughts though. Would it have been a lot different if it had been sort of a purposeful part of a series just with the wrong name? Does that make sense? Like, what was this just the style of someone and they were stuck in that, kind of with my issue with railroad spikes?
So if the purposeful part of the series included a plate that was just flat and a vase that you couldn't put anything in, then yeah, that would probably be okay because you're then using names for things that aren't actually those things.
Yeah.
This is not a pipe.
Yeah. Exactly that. And you're actually potentially inspiring me to kind of do that almost as a ranty series, but like really go to town out of my way to make them as high end as I possibly can and kind of present them in an artistic way but the thing is, I'd probably really enjoy it if I did that because I would feel like I'm having a go at something in the past, but actually it would probably really appeal to the right people and they'd really like them. So I'd shoot myself in the foot. I did say at the beginning this will come across as potentially arrogant, but yeah, I think a lot of it is based around the name. I think it is just that I've got this such strong thoughts about what quantifies as certain forms and shapes that when it doesn't meet those, that it just really irritates me and frustrates me and just go like, it just feels like lying, you know. It's like when someone, you know, it's almost a bit like Top Gear when they go, oh, look, I've got the fastest car in the world. And they turn around and it's like a Honda, whatever. And you're like, well, what makes that the fastest car? Oh, well, because it's a rental vehicle. I will drive that into the ground because I know I don't have to pay out on it and it doesn't care. Like, I get the joke, but it's also clearly not the fastest car in the world. But I'm a lot more lenient towards that because it's clearly coming from a place of humor and it's coming from a place of like, we all know what people are like when they drive that type of car. So yeah, this is me potentially tisming a bit, really, is what we're learning. What was your other point there, Raz, on that? Sorry.
If I can recall.
Don't worry about it. We'll just move on.
That's fine.
Don't have to focus too much on me. Heidi, we back around to you again.
Yeah. So my other irritation is more community based, and it's something that's been happening recently a lot in one of the pottery forums I'm in, where people incite conflict in the community just to like get people riled up. Like, I'll give you an example, and we can all relate to this with AI. So recently in one of the groups that I was in, they posted And I don't know if they were doing this to like get people excited, but it's an example. So they posted a picture that was AI based on prompts that they wanted to explore with their pottery. They were making an owl coil platter. And it took them a while to get the result that they wanted and the position of the owl that they wanted. And so they posted this AI artwork into the pottery forum.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it turned into a big argument between if you're doing art, you should use AI, or you can use AI as a tool, or you shouldn't because it's theft. So like that whole topic is very touchy anyway, in pretty much any art community that you talk through, because there's some people that are environmentalists that are saying like, you shouldn't use AI because it uses too much water to cool the plants that develop the AI. And then there's the people that say, well, AI is theft because the algorithm was built on the backs of other artists. And then there are the people that say, fuck all, like, I can do whatever I want because all of history, art has been stolen.
Yeah.
Ideas have been stolen. It's just replication of ideas in different ways. But the point, the irritation that I have are the people that go into these communities and like throw in these hot button topics and get everybody frustrated and antagonized and uncomfortable. And I never engage in those conversations because I'm like, I don't want to be,
because you're smart.
Yeah. But also like, I don't want to be reminded that this discussion is still going on. Like, it feels useless because you know that there's like so many people that have such diverse opinions about it. And it's just a ploy to like get people engaged on your post. Mm. But it's also like, I don't know. I'm very much like, I like to be positive. I like to have really good interactions with people. And I have my opinions on AI. I have my opinions on how I will use AI, and I will use it. I have my opinions on Kintsugi. I have my opinions on all these things. But I think it's kind of in a community that is supposed to be about encouragement and all that stuff to just willfully toss in a grenade just feels,
it's an invasion of a safe space.
Yeah, it's counterintuitive. Like, I get that you might truly just want to have a discussion so that you can formulate your own opinion, but to do that in a community of 2,000 people, are you really getting educated in the best way? Or are you just inciting violence within the community? Like, it just, it's really, and maybe I'm too sensitive and maybe I, you know, don't belong in those types of communities, but like,
I mean,
it's very frustrating.
Of course you don't belong.
I mean, I'm all femaling.
Yeah.
I would hazard a guess, Rasmus, that in those kind of groups, the females tend to be the dominant group of people. And that is me completely hazarding a guess.
You mean in blacksmithing now?
No, I'm talking about in Heidi's pottery craft.
Oh, no, it's pretty...
Is it an even split?
Yeah, I mean, historically, pottery has been a male-dominated field.
I knew historically. I'm projecting my sexism straight away. And making assumptions that the group that you were in was potentially catered more towards... craft.
No, it's not really like Joanne Fabrics. It's like people that are serious about the craft, people that are, you know, historically have gone to college, have gone to 4-year school.
Right. So it's not the ones who do a little bit on the side in between.
No. It's just like,
not that should make any difference at all. This is just me clearing up my.
No, I mean it totally. I mean, I'm sure it happens in those communities as well. I wouldn't say that it's like women inciting this or men inciting this. It's like probably 50-50, and the response is very much 50-50. There are some men that are environmentalists and are like, "Don't fucking do that." There are some women that are like, I'm going to do whatever makes it easier for me. I'm not seeing a pattern of behavior that's
I mean, that's, gendered. Yeah, that's certainly interesting. And I think the AI debate is always going to rumble on until all of us who were around before it happened have died.
Well, I mean, in the honest answer, historically, people have always had issue with media.
Yeah.
They've looked at magazines as being art theft, like photographs of sculptures being art theft.
Really?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I'm.
The things you miss when you don't study media.
Well, photography itself is a form of that people were very concerned about in the art community because it was an opportunity.
It steals your soul when you take a photo. I know.
I'm not Amish. But it comes with every advancement with media.
Hmm.
Is okay. Will this media steal the soul of artistic expression?
Hmm.
I'm of the understanding that time will only tell, but historically it's been artists will find ways to create art using anything that they can get their hands on. Mm-hmm. And like those discussion points happen, you know, every generation. Yeah. I'm sure in wood turning, I'm sure in blacksmithing, it was, oh, well, you know, you found a cheat code. You found you found some way to like elevate yourself beyond what we understand. So now you're bad. Or, you know, there's certain teachings, right? Like another hot topic in our field is whether or not in a closed form, you need to create an air hole because the piece will explode.
Right.
There are people on the side of the fence that say it will always explode. And other people
who say, I've never done it and it's never exploded.
No, there are people that do it. I've done it. I've done a test to see like, will this explode? And, you know, like there are people that are taught a certain way and, you know, will only stay on that side of like, this is how I was taught. This is my belief system. And, you know, I'm not willing to experience something else.
Yeah.
But I mean, it deviates a bit from my point of like going into a group and throwing a hand grenade just to see like who helps each other and who like starts stabbing each other.
Yeah. I mean, some people just live off chaos.
Yeah.
And you have those in all societies anyway. So it's.
Yeah. I think it's also frustrating though, in some ways that not that it is forgivable, but you could almost understand more if it was a public post on their own social media in order to try and generate interaction. Like that's one of those ways that will probably generate interaction. And if you're trying to get a post that does that and get engagement, then probably a safe-ish one to do. But the fact that they've not done that and they've come into a group that is for discussing technique or current trends or things to try and help people or whatever it may be, and there they've dropped the grenade, and then they've potentially, again, making assumptions, they've not then interacted necessarily with the people below them to have constructive discussions. They've just let it ride, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's where it's just
anarchists.
Like, yeah. That's just, you know, it's the Russians. It's all Russians. That's where it just kind of, it seems pointless. Like if you're going to start a topic in a group, whether it's a group chat or whatever, if you then do not respond to any of the responses to your thing or go, oh, crap, that was unintentional and delete your post, then that's clearly just to get a rise out of a bunch of people and just try and cause a little bit of mayhem.
I'm sure there's some dopamine response, like regardless of whether or not you're posting it on your own page or a group.
Yeah,
like
sat there chuckling on your couch in your mum's basement.
Excellent.
Okay. Raz, second up.
Depends how
deep you want to go into your psyche now. Come on, we're gradually peeling away layers on each of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. I actually have two more, but I'll stick to one of them.
No, that's fine. Do one for now. We might have another round yet. You never know.
The ball bearing test on anvils. Yeah, I'm very, very much sticking to the blacksmithing theme in this.
Good. But you'll have to explain it a bit more because all we've heard so far is ball bearing test.
Yeah.
So is that the weight of what ball can be borne by an anvil? What are we talking about?
This is the quick and easy way to see if the face of an anvil is hardened.
For the layperson, the face is the top bit.
Yeah, the one you hit or try to hit metal on.
Okay.
A lot of people use this and try to measure it by sort of how many percent of bounce back does it have. Like if you drip it and drop it from like 30 centimeters off, does it, how high does it bounce back again and all of those things, sort of to try to infer some kind of quality control on an anvil.
Okay.
And it doesn't mean anything apart from this thing is kind of hard.
Okay.
And historically, so
the actual test is dropping a metal ball bearing of a random diameter from a height,
yeah,
onto the top of an anvil to supposedly, yeah, test how well it has been created and what it, yeah, will, so, what forces it can withstand.
Yeah, a lot of, okay, people try to, and I see this in a lot of blacksmithing group in groups, in a few anvil groups, and generally speaking, just on the social medias, people either trying to see like, oh, look at a really, really good anvil I got a hold of, look at how this ball bearing bounces.
Mm.
And then other people are trying to be fairly scientific about it and go like, oh, it has like 90-something percent recoil? No.
Rebound?
Rebound, that's the good word. We stick to that one, rebound. Many 90% rebound, and think that means it's better, a lot better than an anvil that only got like low 90s or 80% or something. And the fact of the matter, first of all, it doesn't actually matter to the quality of the anvil or how well of a blacksmith you are. Like, surprise, surprise. Another thing is, yeah, the ball bearing test was a thing that was done once, as far as I know, after World War II. Soldiers were sent out into a scrapyard, probably in Germany, with ball bearings, and they were told to take the ball bearing, bounce it off the face of the anvils you see, and where it bounces good, those anvils we keep. Because those were the anvils that had a hardened face on them. Meaning, okay, they were harder than those where it was soft, where it dented the face of the anvil, where all of the energy otherwise would have gone. When it doesn't go back into bounce, it's plastic deformation.
Okay.
But you can't tell anything else from the quality of an anvil other than basically hitting it with a hammer and just listening to it and going like, yeah, that sounds hard. Or, oh, shit, I made a dent in it.
Yeah, so you don't need a bearing to tell you that.
No, and also, like, this is not scientific in any way. If you want to see the hardness of the anvil, you take the anvil to a hardness tester, a really, really highly specialized machine, and it will make a dent. It will measure the force used to make that dent and how deep that dent is with that said force, and you get a Rockwell number that tells you how hard it is. And that's it.
So the bearing technique is the poor man's solution. That's not really a solution.
It's the same kind of test of taking two similar looking steel rods and hitting them against the wall and listening to the sound to figure out which one is harder. Right? Or just taking two similar looking rods of the same diameter and trying to bend it, and you use the one that is stiffer to bend for knives. It's the same kind of test. It doesn't mean anything apart from one is different than the other.
See, my brain instantly was thinking about the amount of variables. Like, let's say you've got this ball bearing and you have no concept of what the makeup of the material is that ball bearing is made from.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're trying to say that that's the same as your hammer, which has got a completely different tool steel head, and says, well, if I drop this from this height, then I know I can get X amount of bounces when striking with my hammer before I need to take a break because I'm tired, or whatever variable you want to put on it.
Yeah.
But your data sets are different.
Yeah.
Like, the amount of mass of the hammerhead and the size of the ball bearing are different. The material it's made from is different. The angle at which you're striking from is different. Like, yeah, okay. So your frustration is it with the test, or was it with the reverence and the belief behind the test?
Yeah. So to be fair, there is something to the fact of hitting the face of an anvil to see the quality of it. Like, if you hit it lightly and dent it, then yeah, that's a really soft anvil. It will probably not last long in a hard work environment. If you take an anvil and you hit it pretty hard and it hardly shows at all, if anything, that's a hardened face. It will last a fair bit longer in a hard environment. If you're a beginner blacksmith, maybe forging a couple of hours a week, no matter the hardness of your anvil, you will never wear that out in your lifetime. And a lot of people seem to hold like the ball bearing test as a mythical, magical result that means that this is worth a lot more. This is a lot better than anything else. And it is not. We are still talking of a chunk of steel.
So does it come back again to lack of education / ignorance and that kind of thing? Or has it come back to there are certain people who haven't realized it's not a valid test, but they've gotten very popular on social media and therefore people have held them with esteem and believe it?
That's more the thing.
Viral misinformation.
Exactly. Russians all over. The same kind of people talking of Damascus steel being the absolute best steel there is. It is like perfect in every single way. And it's like, no, if you make a knife out of Damascus steel, you are using a very, very difficult process to make at best a mediocre knife compared to using a highly specific type of steel for the application and and working around the properties of that steel.
Yeah.
Can I ask a off-topic question?
With go ahead.
Why was Damascus created? Like, why other than like visually stunning thing, is there like a purpose for it outside of just a visual thing?
Yes. Short answer is it means you can take two different steels of one that is maybe too hard and one that's maybe too soft for application and actually blend them together and get a mediocre steel or a steel that has the in-between properties of both of them that might be better for this specific application.
So it's a way of using up odd stock without having to buy more material.
If we are ignoring all of the aesthetics.
Yes. Yeah. If we're talking about like the original people who probably did this before.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think like how what was the discovery and what is the purpose of it?
So
outside of like the viral, like, oh, this is really cool looking.
So Damascus steel today is used interchangeably with pattern welded steel to mean when you use a process purposefully to get an aesthetic effect into steel. Originally, every single culture that was making steel, not iron, but steel, they had to do something akin to pattern welding to blend out the qualities of the steel as they were making it and make this into one solid piece that was homogeneous all the way through.
Okay.
Because when you are making steel, you only get carbon migration into the surface of the steel for the first like fraction of a millimeter. Which means that if you are, which was the traditional quote-unquote way in Norway, was you would forge out the maybe 2 millimeter strips of steel, and then only a fraction of that would actually contain enough carbon to be called steel after you had infused it, so to speak. Getting highly technical.
Yeah, sorry, but, I was trying to fall
asleep. That's helpful.
What they did to even this out and make it a good piece of steel that can have good properties, they would fold it and weld it together many times. Kind of like what people think of is the secret to Japanese katana forging today. Not what they actually do, but what people think they do, if that makes sense.
What they always show in the movies. Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. So it's a mixture of lots of things.
Cool. So I have to hasten to add to everyone, I'm falling asleep because I was tired before we came on, not because of what Raz was saying. My brain did drift off a little bit. I'm not going to lie about that. But yeah. Okay.
I could also have just edited that part out and no one would have known. But now you brought attention.
No, we're going to keep it in. It's going to be our highest rated episode yet. John D. Harvey is going to reach out to all of his blacksmithing friends and make sure that they listen to just that segment to increase our viewership of this episode. And John, I'm fully expecting a message from you when you reach this part of the episode. And we will time how long it takes from the release of this episode to getting that message. Well, I think what's proved really interesting is that we started this episode with the intent of potentially, as we said, having a bit of a rant and getting a few things off our chest and having a bit of fun, which is I think we've kind of done, but at the same time done quite a lot of self-help and analysis for one another of trying to get to the root cause of why things bother us. And, you know, I think it might not be a bad thing for every other season. Maybe we do another episode like this if we feel there's enough for us to talk about on this kind of a thing. because in all honesty, it does make you sort of, you know, evaluate why have you got to this result, and then what are you going to do about it? You know, is it something that you can either go, oh, okay, this is my issue and I just need to move on, forget about it. Or in Rasmus's case, on two different things, he clearly needs to put a huge amount of data out into the world to educate the prospective blacksmithing community.
Which is why he's writing a book.
which he will keep dropping in, by the way, dear listeners. He's been mentioning to us that he's writing a book for at least 2 years now. And all we've seen is him spending a lot of money on other resource material to help him write the book.
Isn't that how you write the book?
Well, you actually need to, like, put pen to paper or hands to keyboard to start creating, at least steal like an artist and copy and paste extracts from the books you've bought.
Yeah, that I can do.
Okay, fine. That's fine. Which leads me comfortably onto my second snob thing about people stealing. No. yes, no, I will do a second one. I will do a second one. So my snobby thing, the second one that really bothers me, and this is partly... It is as a craftsman person, but it's also partly through my day job in retail as well, which is people who kind of think that they are making something when they're not actually doing the work.
Okay.
So we will get people come into us at the shop. So for those who don't know, I work for a company that sells timber and planking. And we will occasionally get people come in and they say, oh, hi, I want to start woodworking. You're like, okay, great. What would you like to start? Oh, well, I want to make a chopping board or a cutting board, which is a good beginner project. Okay. It's like fairly low bar, or you can make it really high bar depending on what you're going to do. And so you walk with them out to the wood yard and they might look around and you can quite quickly tell when they're not actually as interested as they thought they possibly were. And they will go, okay, I'm just looking at lots of wood. I don't know what do I need? Like, what do I need to make this happen? And so you can start having a conversation with them. You can see their eyes glaze over or shutters come down. And they're like, okay, what about this? Can I use this bit of wood? Oh, that's quite expensive. And you're like, well, that's £20. And that would make you like 15 chopping boards, but okay, if you think that's expensive, you know. And so they end up like finding a piece of wood that they think is within their budget and what they had in mind, and then they're like, oh, I've got no tools at all, will you cut this to a certain length for me? And it's like, well, yeah, there's a fee, we can cut it shorter, like particularly if people needed to take a long plank away in a vehicle. It's not, you know, you can't always put an 8-foot board in your vehicle, you might not have a suitable vehicle. Fine, I don't know, can you cut it into like a series of lengths at like 12 inches long for me?
Uh-huh.
Right.
Can you make the cutting board for
and
me?
Can you also plane the other side and square the edges off? And do you guys have like a routing machine to round the edges off, like maybe put a rounded edge on? And I have had to genuinely have a conversation with people coming and doing this and saying, I thought you wanted to make a chopping board. Mm. Oh yeah, but I don't have the machinery. Right. So how is you making a chopping board?
Me making a chopping board for you.
Literally doing 90% of the work. And what you want to do is sand it and put some oil on it. And my frustration with this is two things. One is I can't genuinely tell them what I think in the shop because it's my paid job. And I'd probably get into trouble. And
your response to everything is move to Norway.
Yeah, his response, literally everything. But you know, so there's that element of it. But the other part of it is how these particular type of people who do this can't see why it's a frustration. They can't see how them making a thing actually means they have to have a physical input in making the thing. Like, I am more than willing, like people who know me well enough will know that if someone comes in and they're like, hey, I have zero tools and materials, I have zero knowledge, but I've had this idea. And I want to create a whatever it is. And if they're clearly still passionate about it and they're excited and you can take them through the process of what they need, and they might get taken aback by costs or like the materials or tools they need, but they're not put off and they keep coming back and they're like, you know, and they'll do it. And the first thing they make will go, it's rubbish. It's not what I mean. It's not what I meant, but I'm going to go again. I'm going to have another go. And you can see in their eyes and the way that they act and their mannerisms that they have got the bug of a craft. Like, all of us will go out of our way to help those kind of people. You know, hey, do you want to borrow this tool? It will help you to get this part further along or make this bit easier. Hey, if I just spend 10 minutes with you and show you this technique, you'll get your tools slightly sharper, which will make the job easier for you. It'll mean you get less tear out on the timber. Or, you know, we are all as craftspeople willing to put effort into people to help them get along the journey, because it's paying the knowledge forward that we got from the previous people who we got ours from. But to have someone walk in and want like a flat pack craft project, but not be honest about it.
Send them to IKEA.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I'm waiting for IKEA to release the flat pack chopping board kit. Because it is the kind of thing that would be achievable. They probably haven't done it because the oil would be flammable in shipping or something.
Probably.
But like, do you know what I mean? It's that, it's that kind of thing of, it's like people go, oh, I did a pottery experience day. And what they mean is they sat and painted flowers on a mug that someone else had made. Yeah. And it's like, that's not a pottery experience day. That's painting on a piece of pottery. Like, you've not had any interaction at the mucky stage to get it to that point. And it just feels like people who don't want to get their hands dirty, and they do tend to fit a stereotype, and they do tend to rock up with, you know, with their coffee in their hand, kind of thing. Like, they're not prepared to like move things. We take them, the way we sell timber at our places, it is a self-selection area. It's all racked up. It's behind chains. You hand a person a tape measure and say, if you take a chain off, rifle through the stack, please be a bit careful. If there's something too heavy, give us a shout and we'll help you move it. Otherwise, be tidy and put the chain after you. And they look at you and like, I'm going to have to touch the wood. I'm going to have to like move things around. I'm going to have to get my hands dirty. But yeah, my time is precious. You can't afford to pay me to go through this with you. Like, this is the trade-off. Either we put the price up on the timber and I literally handpick this out for you and tell you exactly why you should choose this piece of wood, or you've got to put effort in and learn stuff.
I have sort of some of the same feelings, I think, about people who say they have forged a knife when they have only been sanding it.
I think that sounds like a very controversial topic of conversation in the knife and bladesmithing world that we're not going to cover.
Well, I don't think it's controversial, but I am very deep in the blacksmithing camp, so who knows?
Yeah, I mean, let's look at that at face value, right? Like, there are people that look, and I've said this before, looking for cheat codes. They either want to make money off of you doing something for them, or they just want the badge of honor to say, like, I am this.
Yeah.
Here's my proof. Here's a photograph of me doing this thing, but I didn't actually do it. In ceramics and in pottery and everything, yes, you're right. There are these shops that give people an opportunity to glaze pre-made pieces. There are shops that give people an opportunity to throw for the first time. And 9 times out of 10, it's the teacher centering the clay so that the person can throw and say they did it. And it's really what they're paying for. It's just an experience to say, like, oh, I got to try this thing. But yes, I do agree that it's frustrating when people come out of that experience and claim to be something that they're not yet, because they had this one experience, or I dipped my toe in and I had this adjacent experience.
I don't think it's even necessarily that, though. I think I can get people going to have an experience. I totally understand that. And like, the person who's teaching has got, right, I've got 3 hours to accelerate you through this process that you've never done before. And you've got to safely reach the other end. And you've got to enjoy it so that you tell all your friends that they should come and spend money with me and do it as well. Like, I get that thing. I think it is the proper equivalent would be someone walking into any of our workshops for a lesson. For like an introduction to your craft, and then doing their utmost to get you to make the thing for them the entire time they're there.
Yeah, I've had that. Like, when I used to do like the painting nights, I used to help support a friend of mine with like craft nights. We did this like pop-up craft thing, and people just wanted to drink and socialize and have someone make the craft for them. Yeah. And that is irritating.
I have a question, Dan. Have you been able to convince some of these people, these sort of secondhand makers, to actually start doing the making themselves?
I'll, you know, In the 9 years I've worked there, it's probably happened five times. So this is not, I'm very glad to say it's not a frequent occurrence. Out of those five, I've probably told four of them, we don't do that. You've got to make it yourself. That's the whole point kind of idea. There was one couple who came in who wanted to, for their first wood turning project, not first project of this type, but first wood turning project ever, was to make a circular resin river coffee table. With no, having no tools, knowledge, or experience. Now they, I started it with saying, right, okay, so what level of experience are you? And they were really honest up front and said, look, we literally know nothing at all, but we want to do a project together, young couple, new house, this is our thing, we both really like the aesthetic, this is what we want to do. And I'm like, you do know that making a circular one can be quite tricky. Yeah, but we've done a bit of research and we've seen you can get like a router with a jig and do all this kind of stuff and everything else. Sorry, let's be correct, they said, we see you can get a router and a jig. And I'm like, no, a router is the thing you use to get the internet in your house. A router, spelled the same way, common mistake, but a router is a high-speed, very dangerous piece of woodworking equipment. I went through with them a rough idea of costs of materials and then a rough amount of time it was going to take them to potentially make it themselves if they were successful the very first time they did it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we are fortunate that 10, 12 houses away from where we work is a guy who has spent the last 5 years making coffee tables, dining tables, or whatever, using resin and wood, and has shopped with us frequently. And he is an exceptionally generous man because he's doing all this after he's retired from his day job. And I rang him up and I said, hey, look, mate, I've got this couple here. They want to do this thing. Are you like at any stage in that? He said, yeah, I've got one at the moment. I'm actually just about to pour one. Like, we're going to do it this afternoon. I said, fantastic. Do you mind if they come up and just have a conversation? He said, no, absolutely send them up. And so I said to them, I said, look, I want you to go visit this guy. I said, I know you came out here to buy stuff. Don't buy anything from me now. Go and see this guy. He is literally the guy to see. He can tell you all of the different things. He can tell you what to avoid and all of that kind of stuff. So they went up there and they spent 3 hours with him up there and he took them through the whole process, like free of charge, nothing to do with it, everything else. And I didn't see or hear from them again, but he came and found me 2 days later and I said, oh, you know, how did you get on with the couple? I said, oh, fantastic. I said, all right, okay, so what they're going to do is we're going to make a table together.
Oh.
And so they came back and bought the timber from us and they bought the resin from us, but they then went to him and he taught them free of charge. And took them through the whole process and said, look, we're going to use my machinery. We're going to use my kit. We're going to use my knowledge. But you are going to make the thing under my supervision. So he minimized the wastage. He minimized, because I don't know about anyone else here listening or you guys in front of me, pouring resin, which is not cheap, as a young couple in your new house, when money's tight, is not an experience that is going to be anything less than highly stressful. Particularly if it goes wrong.
Or rather, so, especially after you soon realize, oh, this is going wrong.
Yeah. Like, why does it not appear to be filling up? Oh, there's a gap. Oh, we're on carpet. Oh, you know, and just it could go everywhere. And so he was able to remove all of those potentials for error and to give them confidence to do the thing. But that is, as I say, that's the one out of five out of 9 years of people. So they still made the thing, but they did it under heavy supervision and the guidance of someone who knew exactly what they were doing. Mm. But they wanted to make it and they did make it. But they asked the right questions and they showed the right information and they accepted the fact that it was possibly beyond what they were expecting, despite everything they'd seen on the internet.
Mm.
And I think that's the difference. That's the whole kind of thing of, we can present you with information and whether you take away from that and go, oh, okay, I understand that I'm not there yet, but I can do baby steps to get me there, whether it's still make the same size project with supervision or whether it's make a smaller project and work my way towards it. But to just not acknowledge the fact that actually you have no interest in doing the thing and that you want someone to make it for you and then you just sand it a little bit and put a bit of finish on it and claim you've made it. I mean, I think it just riles me up. I think it's because for me personally, what I do is like the first hobby that I've not given up. You know, it's the first one that I've kept at and I've developed and I want to become such a level, you know, I have aspirations to become a high level at what I'm doing. And in order to get there, I really need to put more effort into practicing. But that's another story. But, you know, because I've got that and I want to give myself that drive and the practice to get there, and then to see someone else try and cheat code it by piggybacking off my knowledge and experience, it just really rubs me up the wrong way and just kind of makes me feel like, well, why should we help you out? Why should you be the one to get that kind of thing that for you to walk away? I tell you what it really makes me want to do is it makes me want to make the thing for them and then take a massive branding iron that says made by and like brand deeply into it so they can't sand it out without ruining the piece, and then hand it over to them and say, that's free of charge, you can have that one, go and tell all your friends
without any spite at all.
I clearly don't have any undercurrent of anger issues whatsoever. I'm a lovable teddy bear. It's all fine.
Exactly. Sort of.
Anything else we want to cover, guys? We've run slightly longer on this one, but
no, this was fun though.
Yeah. I mean, therapy is normally 50 minutes, I'm told. We're at like an hour and 16, but you know, we'll take the introductions out and all that kind of stuff and the random tangent into blacksmith science, and we'll be down to about 20 seconds.
Random at all.
I asked for it.
You did. Yeah. You did ask for the conversation. Absolutely. No problem at all. I shouldn't comment like that when I know I've gone off on tangents much longer and less interesting. Okay, guys. Well, it's good to chat again. Join us in a fortnight's time. And you'll have to remember, because I never remember to post about it. You just got to have it scheduled in your thing that it pops up. I know we keep saying it, but genuinely, please tell everyone, tell all your friends, your family, anyone you like. Like, if you can work out a way to set up multiple accounts on your favorite streaming apps for free and like chain listen to all of the things, then that would be our cheat code to boost numbers. That'd be amazing.
You can even listen to them on mute. The algorithm doesn't care.
Yeah, listen to it on mute. The algorithm doesn't care. That feels like a really sad t-shirt. Or like a really, really like passive aggressive insult. I listen to your podcast on mute.
That's a lot of sass.
Okay, guys, you can tell I'm getting more and more tired now. It's been lovely chatting, as we said, and we do appreciate the fact, those of you who do listen to us. And if you ever feel willing or able to reach out, either, you know, put some likes on our social media about it, or just pop us an email or even a little message and just say thank you. Doesn't have to be a massive thing, or just say like what you're doing or anything like that. Or even if there's some negative comments about me talking far too much, that's absolutely fine. Be prepared for a long answer. As always, you can find us at Setting Up Shop. That's at setting_up_shop, SHOPPE, on Instagram, or info@settingupshop via email. You can find me at tarrants.co.uk, TARRANTS, Tango, Alpha, Romeo, Alpha, something, TS. You'll forget what N is every time, .co.uk. You can find Rasmus at Rasmus Loewen, and you can find Heidi at Whitehall Pottery. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you're still here at an hour and 20 minutes in, catch you next time. Bye.
See you.
Bye.